You're listening to a podcast of This Positive Life, TheBody.com's growing collection of first-person stories from people living with HIV.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body, and I'd like to welcome you to This Positive Life. I'm here today with longtime HIV survivor and activist Nelson Virgil. Nelson is a former chemical engineer from Venezuela who has been an HIV/AIDS activist for as long as he's had HIV, and he's been living with it since 1983. He lectures extensively around the United States and overseas in both English and Spanish about HIV and its treatment and side effects. Nelson himself has multi-drug-resistant HIV. He's managed to stay healthy and avoid many complications by using early information and research to make educated treatment decisions. Nelson founded the website salvagetherapies.org to disseminate information about treatment options for people with HIV drug resistance. Today, I'll be talking to Nelson about living with HIV all these years.
Hi, Nelson. Welcome to This Positive Life.
Hi, Bunny. Thanks for having me.
I guess the big first question is, can you tell our readers and listeners about your personal history with HIV? How did you find out you were HIV positive?
Well, you know, I'm originally from Venezuela, from South America, and I came to the U.S. in 1984. And, you know, moved here because of my boyfriend back then. And, you know, as you know, back then it was a scary thing, you know, to have HIV, and even to get tested back then was a horrible thing because there were no treatments and no options, and, you know, there was a lot of fear. But he tested behind my back and told me he was positive 2 years later, 1986. So I decided, well, you know, I need to get tested myself, and I did. And so I got, you know, tested in 1986 and found out I was positive. So it's been 21 years since I tested?
So he was living with HIV at least for the 2 years that you were together. And
yeah.
He didn't tell you.
Well, you know, he found out and then he told me. And then,
oh, he told you immediately afterwards?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, I was not looking forward to getting tested because there were many reasons back then. You know, for instance, there was discrimination in the job place. Companies were testing people back then. Without your consent, and there were no treatments available, no hope. You know, and I was an immigrant just coming to the United States to try to make it. So it was not something, it was not a piece of knowledge that really helped anybody back then.
Meaning because there was no treatment?
No treatments, no ACT, no HIV drugs, a lot of fear and a lot of discrimination, you know. So I was really not looking forward to a test. I don't think I would have tested or gotten a test done if it wasn't for him. It would have taken me probably 10 years to do so. So in a way, I guess he saved my life, really.
So, why do you say that?
Because it would have taken me a long time to make the decision on my own. And I just got tested because I knew that we had unsafe sex and chances were that I was positive.
But in those years, was it really there a strong notion that that was unsafe sex?
No. Well, when I met him in 82, 83, you know, HIV wasn't even part of the global discussion, you know. I mean, they found out about the gay cancer in 81, 82, and then, you know, that's when I met my partner, and nobody was using condoms back then. I think the only thing we worried about back then was herpes and STDs. So, you know, we were having a pretty free life when it came to sex in the gay community.
Where were you living at the time?
You know, I was working in Venezuela, moved to Houston to try to make a living here, you know, as an immigrant without a working visa or anything. So it was a big adventure.
So what kind of jobs were you doing?
You know, I'm a chemical engineer per training, and, you know, working in the oil fields in Venezuela. And of course, Houston, Texas is the best city to come if you're a chemical engineer. So I was looking for an engineering job while the oil business was crashing in Houston. So it was a hard time. And then, of course, I find out that I'm HIV positive. So I said, well, I guess I came to the United States to die, not to get, you know, you accomplish the American dream. So that was horrible. It probably was the darkest time in my life. But I decided 3 days after crying for 2 days, I decided that either I would accept my death, early death, or do something about it. So I saw an ad for a training class to become CDC, Center for Disease Control, certified HIV counselor, which is, basically a volunteer position to give people their test results and counsel them if they're positive or negative about, their options. So I decided to take that class, and, it was a 3-week class. And that's how I started being an activist. Basically, like a week or 2 weeks later, after getting my test, I started my training as an activist without knowing I was going to become one. So,
And what happened with your relationship with your boyfriend?
That eventually ended years later, and he eventually died of, of course, AIDS and wasting, and he died in 92, and, we both, decided to go into the ACT, the first ACT study.
ACTG, the AIDS Clinical Trial Network?
It was an ACTG study, studying, back then I don't even think it was called an ACTG, but it was studying, ACT, the first drug, at high doses. We had taken it 4 times a day, 1,000 milligrams a day, and I found out a year later that I was actually in the placebo group, which probably saved my life too, because we found out later that ACT at high doses was actually killing people faster than not. So he was on the treatment arm, on the actual real treatment, and I was on placebo. And I really think, looking back, that probably was what made a difference between both of our survivals. That and many other factors, of course, that I'll probably talk about through the interview.
So who did you tell when after you were tested as positive? Did you tell your parents?
No, not at all. That took me easily 8 years. No, my parents and my family were all back in South America. So
did they know you were gay?
My mom, yeah, before I left. She found out, and that was one of the reasons I left the country, because back then, it's machismo and the cultural problems with growing up Catholic and Latino in South America. Venezuela is not a very open-minded country when it comes to homosexuality. So that was one of the reasons I left. So, yeah, they knew. It was something that nobody discussed, but everybody kind of knew that I was gay. Of course, they find out a lot, a few years later that I'm also actually positive. But no, it took me a few years I found out a job at Shell Oil working as engineer for them. And I was also in the closet, in a double closet with them, not only about being gay, but also about being HIV positive.
But did you have health insurance with them?
Yes, I had health insurance. And I was always wondering if, of course, they were getting the bills. So, and that was always a question in my mind. Somebody knows in this company, but obviously, I didn't really know who besides maybe human resources. But, yeah, that was also stressful for me to keep my identity as a gay man also, and also as an HIV positive person. And I was also becoming, as I said, an activist. I was working during the day and counseling at night, counseling people at night in a free clinic here in Houston, the Montrose Clinic. So, I had like a double life.
So you were counseling newly infected people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was counseling, people that got their HIV negative results and or HIV positives. But back then, I remember clearly, I would say 50% of the people I would see, I would probably see 30 people a night. There was a lot of testing back then. A lot of anxiety. And I would see easily 20 people that are HIV positive sometimes in one night. I mean, it was really, really hectic. And then, it would help because I was already positive myself and dealing with it. So I could tell them, listen, I'm positive too. And yeah, this is a scary thing, but we'll find a way to pull through this. Of course, back then we only had in the late 80s, early 90s, we only have ACT, and then we had, all the other nuclear site analogs like, you know, DDC and DDI and D4T, you know, there were drugs that were not really helping us survive, but some, you know, they had some minor effect. So, you know, I concentrated on nutrition and exercise and vitamins and meditation, you know, anything that could prove to help me, you know, live longer, because there were not many things that you could do.
So what made you so hopeful and so able to deal with a life-threatening illness? Because you were counseling others.
I'm very competitive. I was always raised very competitive. I was raised by a mother that thinks that challenges are just a learning experience. They shouldn't be seen as something bad. So I think I took it as a challenge and also decided to learn as much as I could. Like that course that I took, that training with the CDC, opened my eyes to the fact that I could become an expert in my own illness, even in 1986, 87, when there was not much more than, you know, nothing, no treatments. I realized that, you know, becoming an expert on your own illness was probably going to save me that. And I think many factors. I also had, I still do after 24 years of infection. I'm terrified about being in a hospital bed depending on people. I still do. That drives me to really obsessive about information and keeping myself healthy. I think there's a sense of control. I want to be in control all the time, so I'm actually a control freak. So I have that too. And I was raised by a mother that told me that vitamins were good for you, that pills are not bad for you, that exercise, you know, you would get up every morning and walk and run around, you know, jog. So I was raised already with a mindset that pills are not bad. Exercise is actually good for you. Eating well, having some faith, and having seeing something as a challenge, not as something that is going to destroy you. So I think, you know, I don't know. I wanted to prove that I came to the United States for the right reasons, and I wanted to follow the American dream. I didn't want to die here. So I guess that was another way of coping with it. I really don't know. I'm not that special. I'm just maybe probably just lucky to be alive this long too. So.
But you were counseling people in a pretty hopeless moment.
Yes.
To be hopeful.
Yes. Even back then, yes.
So that's amazing thing.
I think what really helped me is to get out of my head. I was so terrified. So I was only, 25, 26 back then. So terrified to die young and die in this country by myself. I had no family. My relationship was breaking apart. He went inwards and I went outwards, meaning when he found out he was HIV positive, he didn't tell anybody, not even his best friends. He didn't want anybody to know. He didn't want to take any classes. He didn't want to learn, read. He wanted to completely ignore that. And in my case, I went outwards, meaning I wanted information. I wanted to find out. So that in itself helped even, you know, break us up even more. So the way people cope as a couple is sometimes so different that they break up. But anyways, it's just amazing. But I think it's just a personality trait. It takes a certain personality to not be overwhelmed with information, but to actually thrive with a lot of information. And maybe I'm one of those. So.
And so, what kind of nutrition and exercise stuff were you recommending to patients back then?
Well, I don't recommend, you know, I'm not a doctor. So.
Yeah, no, but...
but, you know, no, actually...
What was helping you? What kind of things were helping you feel better?
Well, I started reading a lot of the, you know, bodybuilding magazines because my first fear, I mean, for those of us that got tested before 1996, we had two huge fears. The first one was wasting syndrome. We didn't want to end up in bones, and because that was the first way for people to know that you have AIDS. So for instance, you know, wasting syndrome was like number one in our, when you were told you're HIV positive, at least I did, the first thing that came to my mind is, oh my God, I'm going to end up in bones in a wheelchair with KS lesions on my face. That's the first thing that I thought. I said, well, I don't ever want to end up that way. So I became obsessed on preventing wasting syndrome. while all my friends, most of my friends were already sick and getting sicker, and every weekend we had memorial services for years. So death was around most of us back then. It was almost like being in a war and having, you know, planes flying on top of you, bombarding the city, and you didn't know when the next bomb was going to fall on you. I know it sounds dramatic, but that's how I felt. So you were like looking for a shield to protect yourself from the next bomb. So that's how I felt. So I started reading a lot of magazines on bodybuilding and nutrition, became very obsessed. I'm an engineer, so I guess you can say I love science and information and stuff. And I started learning that, you know, a lot of these people were putting on lean body mass, and they looked, you know, they looked like the opposite of a wasting patient was looking back then. So I concentrated on high protein and working out with weights 3 times a week for an hour, and became very focused on that. And especially when my partner, ex-partner, who we're still friends, had already lost 60, 70 pounds and, you know, around me. And I started looking into hormones like testosterone and anabolic steroids, which back then were, well, still now, pretty much criticized by everybody. And so, you know, and vitamin supplementation, there was some research on deficiencies in HIV. And then in 1988, I started reading the work that Dr. Donald Kotler had done on wasting. And some other researchers started looking at testosterone deficiency. So by the late 80s, we were having a notion that nutrition, hormone balance, and exercise may help us live a little longer, or a lot longer, while we waited for drugs to come through and you know, control the HIV virus. So that was that's a long search. And, you know, eventually I decided to make all the research, because I read and read and went to libraries. Back then, remember, we did not have the internet back then. And that's how old we are, some of us are. And a lot of this research had to be done. You had to go to a library to do this. So I went to a library every weekend and read on nutrition and all that, until eventually I met somebody. I found another job with Shell, and they transferred me to Los Angeles, and that's where I met very progressive, I would say, patients like me that were really on top of it. And, you know, they're all dead now, but I learned a lot from these guys, you know, through support groups. And they told me, hey, Nelson, you know, hormones and nutrition and supplements, that's you know, look at us. We're looking good. We're not wasting. So I finished up with my research and ended up writing a book about it.
What support groups did you join? Which organizations?
The best one was Marion Williamson's. You know, she's now a very well-known author and speaker and motivational speaker. And yeah, Marion Williamson, she opened a group in West Hollywood. It was actually... what do you call that? Food pantry. I forgot the name. Angel something. Project Angel Food or something. And she would have support groups where you would come. A bunch of us, like 40 of us, would come and sit on the floor. And she would sit on the floor with us. And she kept repeating to us that we were not victims. That we were not victims. That we could take charge. That even if we die young, we need to make the best of our lives. You know, it was all about shifting the mentality from being a victim to being empowered. And oh my God, that I really think that woman really had a lot to do with my shift and taking charge of my life. You know, I love her, by the way. I'm very biased. People think she's a spiritual guru, and sometimes people criticize her for many things. But yeah, she was. And back then, we also had other support groups where Louise Hay, which I really, really like her. She said that she kept saying that you only got sick if you didn't love yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So we would have a whole stadium full of people with HIV listening to this woman. And I was like, no, she's not, you know, it's not about loving yourself. I mean, many people are loving themselves and they're still dying. So yeah. The Marion Williams support group was definitely the place where I met the coolest guys with the most information.
And that was very important back then because there wasn't a lot of information.
Oh, no. No internet. The only newsletter I would get by mail is John James, 8th Street News. I love John. He's still alive. He's healthy. He's not HIV positive, but he's my... I even tell him now, it's like, God, you know, I used to get your newsletter and I used to like wait for it. We used to open the envelope like because we didn't have the internet. And of course, Project Inform back then was also, I would get their newsletters by mail. So that was the only way that we knew what was going on, you know? So people forget how far we've come.
Yeah, or how difficult it was to get, you know, like information from the conferences.
No, not only that, we couldn't even get to the conferences. Only doctors and researchers and very few media people were allowed in conferences back then. It was a different world, very different.
What was the first conference that you went to, research conference for HIV? Do you remember?
Yeah, the Berlin conference. I managed to get a scholarship somehow. And that's when they told us that... the Concord study had been finished and the ACT data was out, and we found out that ACT was actually killing us faster in the high doses, of course, that were used back then. So that was a very depressing conference. And then, of course, I went to the Vancouver conference in 1996, when HART was introduced, and we were talking about getting rid of the virus, you know, Dr. Hall.
Eradication,
and oh, my God, we're going to be saved. So, yeah, and of course, after 96, I've been to every single retrovirus conference, and, oh, you know, I became extremely active after 94 when, it's a long story, but I got... my membership. I applied for the community advisory board in at the ACTG, the AIDS Clinical Trials Group, and that for me was the most wonderful experience because it's like a school where you learn how to interact with researchers and also learn how to interact with doctors and how to read a research protocol, a study, and how to look at data, how to. So in a way, I volunteered for 3 years there, and it was like my school to give me the skills to do what I'm doing now. So
I guess what I didn't ask you was, when you were first diagnosed, did they give you a CD4 count?
Oh, no, not at all. CD4s, I forget when they were first, when I first saw my first CD4, I know it took at least 2 or 3 years. No, back then all you got was the HIV test, and they told me to go home and pray and eat well and take care of my business, like, you know, put my documents in order. I don't know. Deep inside of myself, I had this feeling that the more information I had, the more chances I would have to make it through, you know. So here I am, you know, 48 years old and getting older with HIV and... you know, 24 years later. So,
does anyone have any idea how you survived when so many other people died?
No, Bonnie, I think we are finding out more and more that it's a combination of factors. I think we haven't really found out yet. I think we're getting closer to starting to find out what we call polymorphisms, you know, genetic factors that make somebody probably have a longer... better survival. But I think other factors were like I really prevented weight loss, unintentional weight loss and wasting. That bought me a few years, I'm sure of it. Exercise, you know, in combination with nutrition and testosterone and all that, that really made me, I think whoever survived till 96, 97, of course, we made it through the wave of HART, of the introduction of protease inhibitors. So we were able to survive longer. But many of us, many of my friends and my partner, I had two partners actually died, they did not make it to 96. So, of course, you know, those of us that did make it through 96, 97 were exposed to the new drugs. So, but I think, I really think I would have died before 96 if I hadn't taken care of my nutrition, exercise, hormones, and prevented weight loss, you know, unintentional weight loss. That would have killed me. I probably would have been dead by 93, I'm sure of it. So, you know, I got some time, you know. But is that the reason why I'm alive? No, it's a combination of factors. It was that, heart, maybe some, the fact that I have faith. No faith, like God faith, but I have faith that I could take care of my health and control my outcome. And maybe I do. Maybe I have some genetic factors that also gave me some advantage on that. I have never, by the way, something I haven't said in this interview is that I had never achieved undetectable viral load until probably, you know, a year and a half ago for 6 months only. So I have been living with a viral load over 5,000 for 21 years. And that in itself is really a miracle. So
what was your CD4 count when you first got tested? Whenever that was.
620 around there. Yeah.
620.
Yeah, so I was pretty healthy when I found out, and in a way, as I said, my partner back then, you know, probably saved my life because I found out early on.
So you think you were recently infected when you were diagnosed?
I was probably infected on March 13, 1983. I know the date because I was very symptomatic after that. I went through that viral syndrome where. You know, I had a flu for 2 months, and my lymph nodes got inflamed everywhere. I had fevers and thrush, and I had all the symptoms. Of course, back then, I didn't know what it was. I thought it was a bad flu that I had caught in the United States through, you know, I came here for a conference and then went back home. I met my partner back in the conference. So, yeah, I remember when I got it, 1983, for sure. I'm 100% sure of it.
Right. So for you to, you know, did you have symptoms and, like, after that, like in the 10 years after that? Because it takes an average person who gets infected 10 years to even have a symptom. So.
Oh, yeah. Diarrhea. Uh-huh. I lost. My average weight was back then was 168. I went down to 140 pounds unintentionally. Diarrhea. Yeah. Lots of depression, of course. But, yeah, diarrhea was a big thing. Yeah.
But you didn't have any OIs?
No. I have never had opportunistic infection, no. Even now, you know, 24 years into it, I have never had PCP or anything. I've been under 200 twice in my life.
Under 200 CD4 count?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And right now I'm at 325, and of course I'm on the integrase inhibitor, and Merck integrase, and Truvada, and Ryotas, you know. So I'm actually in a study. I'm always on the latest thing because I'm trying to, you know, as I say, I'm a long-term survivor, and I've developed multi-drug resistance. My virus has resistance to all protease inhibitors, all nucleoside analogs, all non-nukes, and now I have resistance also to integrase.
And so can you, I guess for people who don't really understand resistance, can you talk a little bit about how you became resistant? Was it because you didn't take your medications on time?
Good. I'm so glad you asked me that question because I'm so tired. I am so tired of going to conferences, going to classes, going to seminars, where the doctors keep saying that people that have resistance or their virus have mutated, their virus have, the drugs have stopped working on controlling their viruses. The main reason, and probably the only reason, is because they didn't take their meds on time or they didn't really stick to the regimen, et cetera, et cetera. That is probably true. It's number one in the list of reasons. But for somebody like me, a long-term survivor, I have taken my meds on time every single time. I've probably forgotten here and there once a month to take it within the hour. So I have been, my adherence has been 100%. But people like me that have been positive forever were on monotherapy of nucleosides for easily, I forget, from 89 to 96. Or 94, around there, we were on monotherapy of nucleosides or dual therapy of nucleosides. We developed resistance, or our virus mutated, became stronger, and became strong, and a nucleoside analog stopped working there. Then we were exposed to protease inhibitors on top, combining them with nucleosides where, you know, that we had resistance to. So we were on what we call virtual monotherapy.
And there were no resistance tests. back then, so you didn't
back then,
know.
No. When was the genotype? Resistance test was not introduced until, I forget, 98, I think, 97?
Very late, yeah.
Yeah, 97. So, yeah, we kept making the same mistake, adding the new drug that was approved on top of drugs that were already failing us. And I don't want to repeat that. Drugs that were failing us. We're always saying the patient failed the drugs. No, drugs are failing us. So I'm very strong. I feel very strongly about that. And yes, adherence is number one. It's one of the number one or two reasons why people develop resistance. But number two is that we have history of resistance because of monotherapy or virtual monotherapy. Three, some of us may or may not absorb drugs the same way. Four, you know, blood levels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I really want to make sure, I mean, it really frustrates me when I only hear doctors talking about adherence as the only reason to develop resistance, because it is not the only reason. Anyway, I'm sorry, I got a little...
No, that's okay.
...activist. I have my own personal feelings about it, because it really feels like we're always blaming the patient, and it's not 100% true all the time that it's all... We're all to blame because of, you know, because we develop resistance. Therefore, we are bad patients, you know.
So tell me about your being proactive in terms of getting on clinical trials. So what makes you decide?
I know.
And how, when do you do this? Like, you're on a regimen.
Yeah, I think, and I don't want to be criticized for this, but I think it's joining a clinical trial can have a lot of benefits. Obviously, but also a lot of disadvantages. In my case, I've probably joined easily maybe four or five studies to get access to a new drug, because they're not approved and it may take a while to get them approved. So I've never joined a phase two study, which is an early study. I think there are too many risks involved with that. But I've joined phase threes, which are larger studies. We know a little bit more about the drugs. I usually join a study for one reason only, to get access to a new drug. Because, yes, I'm looking for the next best thing. I have taken probably more risks than I should have. I look back, and, of course, it's easy to look back and say I should have, I could have, I whatever. But I have taken probably too many risks by doing so. Why? Because every single study until recently have only allowed the use of one investigational drug at a time, meaning you're adding one investigational research drug and you add it to a failing regimen. So that in itself was not something that was, we didn't know better back then, but it didn't serve me. And actually, I built up more and more resistance as time went by.
So nowadays, the notion is you need two active agents in any regimen.
Preferably three.
And three. I mean, three is ideal, but have to have at least two
agents, two medicines that your virus has never been exposed to and has not developed resistance to. Drugs that your virus has sensitivity to. So, and thank God now we have the genotype and phenotype tests that are able to tell doctors, you know, in a better way, whether or not a drug has a good chance to work on you or not. But, and now we have also several drugs, new drugs coming through more or less is very close to each other. So we are able to combine new drugs together for the first time in probably 10 years. Mm-hmm. So I really think we're going through the second wave of hearts right now, really right now.
So it's a very exciting period now.
Oh, yeah, very exciting, and especially for people like me that have developed resistance to nucleosides and non-nukes and even protease inhibitors. You know, we have persistent activists, two second-generation protease inhibitors. We're going to have second-generation non-nucleosides. Of course, the integrase inhibitor class is coming through right now and seems to be very good.
Are you taking that?
Yeah, I'm taking the Merck valtegravir. We used to call it MK-518 integrase inhibitor, which is taken twice a day without Norvir. And I'm also taking Reatas, which is a protease inhibitor that I've got resistance already to, but it's a long story. I'm just taking it because it helps boost the integrase inhibitor a little bit. And I'm also taking Truvada, which is two drugs. It's Viriat and Intriva. And I also have resistance to those, but those drugs that you have the level of resistance to can also help you out to stabilize your health. That's all I want to say right now, without getting into details about viral fitness and all that. So people ask me, why are you taking drugs that you have the resistance to? So
right.
There are some benefits to that, and that's another topic I guess we can talk about.
Right. So are you taking other medications besides the HIV medications?
Oh, yeah. I'm a walking pharmacy.
And are you doing this because your physician tells you to do it, or are you doing it because you tell yourself to do it?
No, medications. I only take medications that my physician tells me to take. Of course, I do my own research and ask them, and I have a very good doctor. I'm taking Famvir, which is a drug to treat herpes and shingles and things like that. There's some good research that's starting to show that people that, especially I have shingles in the past, that had many flare-ups of herpes-related infections may benefit from continuous dosing of Famvir. I'm also taking testosterone replacement every 2 weeks with an injection.
And how come you're doing that, taking the testosterone?
I've been doing it for 14 years because my body does not produce normal levels of testosterone. And testosterone can prevent HIV wasting-related weight loss. It can also prevent depression, fatigue, sexual dysfunction. It's a very important hormone to have, normal levels in your blood.
And how did your physician tell you to get your levels checked?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, I research, I find out about things, and then I talk to my physician about it. That's what being proactive is. A proactive, empowered patient is a patient that reads, gets newsletters like from the body. The body, I'm not plugging you, but you do have a great website. Finds out things that they probably haven't heard of before, and they print it out or email it to their doctors and discuss it with their doctors. So back then in 1993, testosterone was not even part of the conversation back then. And I found out, hey, this is a problem that 40% of us may have. So I talked to my doctor, oh, sure, let me test you. And I came out, my results came up low, and I started getting treatment because of that. But no, there are many treatments that are not part of what we call the standard of care. And only the squeaky wheel gets the grease in this one, meaning, if you don't ask for it, you won't get the test. So I tell people, the more you know about your health, the more able you are to ask your doctor for the right test. And people say, well, why should I do that? My doctor should know everything. My doctor should know what to test me for. I said, well, doctors are human beings. They're busy. If you don't complain about symptoms, why would they spend the money or the time to test you for something? So
does your doctor treat you like a partner in terms of making decisions?
Yeah, my doctor really treats you like a partner. Of course, I'm a difficult patient because I'm always asking him stuff, bringing him stuff that he probably hasn't seen because I'm always, reading. But yeah, he's not threatened by my knowledge. He embraces it. Dr. Chana Schrader, he's one of the best here in Houston, probably one of the best in the South, I'm sure. He's a partner of my health. He's actually he makes decisions. He doesn't make my decisions, my health decisions. I do. He facilitates them, and of course you need somebody to prescribe also. So, but yeah, you always need to make sure that your doctor is your partner in health, not somebody that tells you what to do.
How did you choose your doctor? I mean, I know everyone has difficulty finding someone who they can partner
with.
That's
a good question. People talk. So I tell people. Support groups. When you go to a support group, if there are five people there, people talk. You just ask or start talking to them, and people start saying, well, I went to this doctor. He's got really bad manners, or he treats me like I'm inferior, or he has, I can sense that he's got homophobia or HIV phobia, blah, blah, blah. We all talk. So, or they say, oh, he's sweet and wonderful. This doctor is great, but he doesn't know much about HIV, but he's so nice. So, you know, it is a conversation. So support groups are a good source, calling AIDS service organizations. So sometimes, well, they can't really recommend doctors. But I would say online, you know, internet support groups online, discussion groups. I have a huge one, almost 3,000 people.
And what's the name of your support group online?
My discussion group is POZ Health, P-O-Z Health, at yahoogroups.com.
And anyone?
You go to yahoogroups.com and search for POZ Health, like P-O-Z, like the POZ magazine, POZ Health, and you join. You know, they,
anyone who's positive can join, or even
anybody that is positive, anybody that is not positive, anybody that cares to read, anybody. I'm the moderator and founder, and there are almost 3,000 people now, 4 years old, and I have, you know, anybody can join, anybody, even spammers, of course. But I keep I moderate, meaning I delete emails before they're posted if I don't think they're the right emails for the group. Or if they're from spammers, or if they're from, you know, people trying to sell something. So I keep the groups really clean. Nobody attacks anybody, you know, so I'm very proud of it. It's probably the largest internet group out there. Besides, of course, groups supported by websites like yours, where you have a lot of people asking experts. I mean, that the body.com has probably the most experts on the internet, where people can actually ask questions to doctors and experts in every single topic. So whoever, I tell people, whoever has a computer has an amazing amount of information available to them. The key is to pick the right sources, because there's so much out there that you can get overwhelmed easily. So, you know, yeah, thebody.com, plus health at Yahoo Groups. There are many other, of course, websites and newsletters out there that you can get weekly or biweekly with summaries. But the first thing that people tell me is that, Nelson, I am really overwhelmed. There's too much information out there. Can I find a place where the information is either digested or summarized? Especially a newly diagnosed. The newly diagnosed have a lot of problems with too much information. It's a hard thing. Well, there are people like us, I guess, doing the job.
So now I have some questions about your activism. I know you've been an activist for so many years. So living with HIV all these years, don't you get sick of talking and thinking about HIV? How do you have the stamina to still be on the subject?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I need to get a life. You know, I do.
I'm not trying to dissuade you.
No, I do. I really do. I mean, I breathe, eat, sleep. Everything is HIV. Why? Because, I don't know. I'm, by the way, I'm on disability. I'm on permanent disability. I'm not an engineer anymore. I've been working in this, you know, from home, basically, and lecturing, traveling since 1994. So all I've been doing, really, is all about HIV. So, you ask me how I actually keep myself going and working in the field of, you know, my own interest. I think, and this is going to sound corny, but, you know, I my viral load is 6,000 right now. I don't feel like nobody does have the security of having undetectable viral load and a very stable health outcome or outlook. So that drives me to know more. My mom raised me to be a hero, so she always said I could save the world. So I guess I'm still believing what she said. And, I do, you know, I like helping people. I also like getting feedback that, helping people. I have an ego. I love, you know, speaking, as you can tell. And I just think it's great, you know, to travel and help. And I don't know. I think I was born to do this. I don't believe that there's such a thing as destiny or, oh, I got HIV because of a reason. I really don't believe that. But hey, you know, I've channeled my anxiety of being HIV positive in a good way, I think. And maybe I have found my life purpose. And I even wonder what would happen if I was cured tomorrow of HIV. You know, what would happen? Because I would not have HIV to work on. So No, I always say I'm going to stop next year. I'm going to go, you know, find a real job and do something different. But no, as long as people need help and we don't have a cure, then, you know, we all have a job to do.
So I know you talk about HIV across the country. What is a typical lecture like, and what do you talk about? Why do people come and hear you?
Anything. It depends on what's hot. You know, I mean, I talked from 1993 to 96, 97, 8 about wasting syndrome. That was my main topic. I became like the wasting syndrome guy. Then lipodystrophy started showing up in 97. So I talked about lipodystrophy from 97 to 99. Then lipoatrophy became more evident, you know, fat loss under the skin compared to the what we used to call the Crixie belly. So I talked a lot about lipoatrophy. Then around 99, all side effects started hitting us hard, all of them, all kinds of side effects. So I started talking about side effect management, how to take care of your health and your side effects. Adherence. Then, of course, I speak in, you know, my Spanish is my main language. That's why I have this thick English, thick Spanish accent. But I do lectures in Spanish about general treatment information, and adherence, and cultural issues, resistance, salvage therapies. You know, meaning, you know, treatments for people like me. Nutrition, exercise, wellness, side effect management, anything. I mean. Anything you throw at me. I love research. If I don't know it, I'll find out, you know. So, yeah, right now my latest topics are, of course, new drugs, salvage therapy. I know you hate the word salvage. Let's call it rescue therapy. How to combine new medications, the new data on integrase inhibitors and maraviroc and all that stuff. So it depends. It depends on what. And some people sometimes call me and say, Nelson, I want you to talk about issues for Latinos or men health or, you know. So, yeah, I have a lot of different formats.
And who invites you? Like, what kind of venues are you speaking
to? Usually nonprofit, HIV-AIDS nonprofit organizations.
And
me or call me and find out about me, and then I have to find some way to pay my way there. And that's where, you know, you have to ask for grants from pharmaceutical companies, and that's when I have to be really careful on how I do my job, because I can only work with unrestricted grants from pharmaceutical companies so that they do not control what I say. So it's like a tricky job, but, you know, treatment education is a very difficult job in the United States because there is no money from the federal government to fund seminars and lectures to educate patients. So we need the money from pharmaceutical companies, and yet we have to be very careful on how we inform patients without any biases, and that's hard to do. I have to keep aware of that daily, basically.
Hmm. So what do you think are the biggest ongoing problems that need fixing in HIV, I guess, in the U.S. today?
Well, we need a cure, so we need more research on vaccines and immune therapies, that's for sure. Number one, definitely number one. We don't know all we need to know about immune response and all that stuff, and vaccine research is basically not in its infancy, but we have a long way to go. Access is still a problem. There's some waiting lists in two or three states, although that's gotten a lot better. But the access to treatment to those that have no insurance, no way for paying these drugs. I mean, the average cost per year for first-line therapy, meaning therapy for people that just starting therapy, is around $12,000. For people like me, the bill goes up to around $40,000 a year. So, and over 60 to 70% of us living in the United States with HIV don't have insurance, or are on Medicare or Medicaid. So, you know, access is a huge problem, in the U.S. And education, you know, more than, 25% to 30% of people that are infected do not know they have HIV, so, and they're infecting others, and they're not, of course, taking care of their health. So educating people about testing and getting tested and what you can do and all that, we still have a long way to go, especially with African Americans and Latinos and minority groups, we still have a long way to go with that. And, you know, and fighting the perception that AIDS is we already have a cure, that AIDS is not a big deal anymore. That's huge. And especially in young kids, I get emails every day, and sometimes people find my number somehow, and they call me, and I'm getting a lot of emails from young kids in their early 20s that are getting infected, and especially with the use of crystal meth, and so a lot of use of especially crystal meth. I'm very concerned about crystal meth use in the gay community. But we have a lot of challenges, especially with an administration that doesn't seem to get that. You know, safe sex education is important, and not talking just about abstinence. So, you know, and of course we're in paradise, of course, in the United States compared to Africa or, you know, developing countries too. So everything is relative. What's a challenge for us may be blessing, you know, for them. So I think I'm also very concerned because activism is, I'm not saying it's dead, otherwise I would not be working on it, but we don't have the degree of urgency. Right. You know, we used to hear about ACT UP and all the things ACT UP used to do, almost like, you know, people were afraid of ACT UP, and yet ACT UP did so much for all of us. I'm probably alive because of ACT UP too. But we don't have an ACT UP anymore. We don't have that kind of sense of urgency to really raise hell when we need to.
But do you think there's a lack of people? There's a lack of, you know, people who are living with HIV who want to be known as living with HIV and go out and, you know, protest and do you think that's a problem?
No, I think, well, yeah, of course, you know, there are many people that don't want to disclose. Of course, yeah, I understand why, too. There are many factors. But no, it's really the lack of urgency, the lack of sense that if we don't do something about it now, we're going to die. That's being removed. Even, you know, people like me, you know, I'm not completely, quote unquote, controlled. My viral load is still, you know, over the undetectable level. And yet, I think we're all falling asleep. I think there's a sense, a little bit of hopelessness in a way, in many of us, that we feel almost like there's not much we can do to change things. I don't know whether that's a communal thing that we're going through in this country right now. But, yeah, there are many factors. I'm not complaining. I'm not saying, hey, you know, everybody should be working their asses off on HIV. No, we don't have the sense of urgency that we used to. But yet there are many unresolved issues that we need a lot of work on. But as I say, most of us are working as volunteers, or most people are going back to work, too, and getting they're worrying about paying their bills and doing their jobs and having a family. So there are many factors. I don't think it's everybody's fault. It's just that that's where we are.
I have just a little bit of time left, and I wanted to ask a little bit about how you manage to find a partner living with HIV.
Oh, man, that's hard. that's actually hard, and that's the first question people ask me when they find out they're positive, because, of course, their dating, the dating scene becomes a lot more complicated. You know, and for gay men, it's bad, but for straight people, it's even worse because of many issues. I mean, not only disclosure, but the fact of shared numbers, you know, the numbers out there. So you're asking me personally?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's, in a way, easier right now because most people are meeting online, and you can disclose before you even meet somebody. So that makes it easier so that you don't get emotionally involved with somebody before telling them. So it's easier to disclose before you even have the first date online. Face-to-face is always harder for some reason. It's very hard to date somebody that is not HIV positive if you're positive. Very hard. I hear it all over the place. Because of not only the fear of infecting them, but also the emotional side of HIV. You know, sometimes we talk about side effects and we talk about how bad we're feeling or fears of death or whatever it is. And we need a partner that can empathize with that and actually probably know what we're talking about by going through what we're going through. So it's very hard. It's very hard. I think that the newly infected asked me what's the hardest part of just finding out you're HIV positive now. I said, well, you know, besides just taking medications, and some people don't have to, but it is really the dating thing. If you're single, disclosing is a hard thing to do for many of us because we're afraid of rejection. And once we disclose, if we're lucky to find somebody that is HIV positive too, or even HIV negative, but what we call HIV friendly, there are other issues there too, you know, so about safe sex and risk of infection, et cetera, et cetera. So I really, now somebody should write a book about this, actually, not me, but somebody should. As I said, you know, I met my partner online, and that helped out a lot. It's a lot easier to disclose than when you meet somebody face-to-face, and for me. And I hear from other people that they feel the same way.
And how long have you been together?
We've been together 11 years.
Uh-huh.
Years, yeah, I'm a lucky man. So it hasn't been easy all through. I mean, whoever thinks that having a relationship, you know, you need to work at it. You know, you need to stay awake every week and make sure that you're fulfilling your needs and somebody else's. And that's the hardest part, when we become unconscious and we take things for granted, because I have several times. But I can say 11 years, and it's been a good ride. So, and I'm here to stay. So I'm a lucky man.
And I guess finally, I just wanted to know what your health regimen is in terms of, like, do you meditate? Do you take vitamins? Do you juice? Like, what are the things that you do every day? You know, that's not medications, like, you know, to keep healthy.
I work out 4 times a week for an hour. Try to eat as balanced as I can, you know, nuts and protein sources, meats. Yeah, you know, I'm a meat eater. Vegetables, fruits. I do take probably more vitamins than your average HIV positive person, and I have my reasons. I only take vitamins and supplements that have some data behind them, and maybe one other day we can talk about this. Try meditation, and I cannot do it for some reason. My mind just goes all over the place. I've tried yoga. I couldn't stick to it either. I'm really trying hard to find other ways to find balance. Exercise is the only way right now for me. And as I said, being active and helping people, I spend too much time online, maybe 2-3 hours a day, moderating my internet groups and my websites and helping people there. But at the same time, I love doing that. I think that also helps my health. I really do, to get you out of your head. Counseling, I really believe, to be honest with you, my biggest T-cell, CD4 cell losses in my life have been when I've been really depressed or going through a breakup or something really dramatic like that. I lose CD4 cells. So I really believe in the power of getting counseling, getting therapy. And there are many places where you can get free therapy and free counseling in this country, especially for HIV. Call your, you know, AIDS service organization. So that's important. I think that people don't even talk enough about that. Preventing and treating depression, because depression is the number one reason why people don't take their meds and their CD4s go down. Because I've seen it in my life. Every time I lose T cells dramatically, it's because I'm going through a mental, you know, I'm feeling depressed or high anxiety. So I think that really, and I do believe in that. And I'm not religious, so I'm a little spiritual, but that's it, really. I don't have much more than that, you know. And having a support group, having people to talk to, friends, good friends, a good family, a partner, helps to have a partner. I really do. There are studies that show that people with good relationships tend to live longer, too.
Uh-huh. And you have virtual support groups. So even people who are afraid to go to a regular support group where they're seeing people face to face, you can join a virtual support group.
Yeah, you can stay home in your underwear and type questions or even chat with people that are HIV positive, and you know, nobody has to see your face or see if you look, you know, the certain way. So yeah. I mean, I think once again the internet can also isolate us. So I tell people to be very careful because we are more connected, and yet many of us are becoming more isolated too, because we're not getting out there meeting people, but we're actually, you know, doing such online. So we have to be careful about that too.
Well, Nelson, I could talk to you forever. I can talk to you for hours and hours, but I think people only want to listen to this for 1 hour. So I have to bring this interview to a close. So thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and I'm sure we'll talk to you again about a lot of other subjects.
Thanks so much for having me again, buddy. You take care.
Thanks for listening to This Positive Life. For more podcasts and other first-person stories, please visit us online at thebody.com. If you'd like to share your story, please email us at podcast@thebody.com.